for returning to Hogwarts as well." Ron turned to stare incredulously at Harry as his mother hoisted the laundry basket and the teetering clock into her arms and stormed out of the room. "Blimey, you can't even make a joke round here any more." But Ron was careful not to be flippant about Voldemort over the next few days. Saturday dawned without any more outbursts from Mrs. Weasley, though she seemed very tense at breakfast. Bill, who would be staying at home with Fleur, much to Hermione and Ginny's pleasure, passed a full money bag across the table to Harry. "Where's mine?" demanded Ron at once, his eyes wide. "That's already Harry's, idiot," said Bill. "I got it out of your vault for you, Harry, because it's taking about 5 hours for the public to get to their gold at the moment. The goblins have tightened security so much. 2 days ago, Archie Philpot had a probity probe stuck up his... Well, trust me, this way's easier." "Thanks, Bill," said Harry, pocketing his gold.
"He is always so thoughtful,"
purred Fleur adoringly, stroking Bill's nose. Ginny mimed vomiting into her cereal behind Fleur. Harry choked over his cornflakes, and Ron thumped him on the back. It was an overcast, murky day. One of the special Ministry of Magic cars, in which Harry had ridden once before, was awaiting them in the front yard when they emerged from the house, pulling on their cloaks.
"It's good Dad can get us these again,"
said Ron appreciatively, stretching luxuriously as the car moved smoothly away from the burrow, Bill and Fleur waving from the kitchen window. He, Harry, Hermione and Ginny were all sitting in roomy comfort in the wide back seat.
"Don't get used to it. It's only because of Harry," said Mr. Weasley over his shoulder.
He and Mrs. Weasley were in front with a ministry driver. The front passenger seat had obligingly stretched into what resembled a two-seater sofa.
"He's been given top-grade security status, and will be joining up with additional security at the Leaky Cauldron, too."
Harry said nothing. He did not much fancy doing his shopping while surrounded by a battalion of Aurors. He had sewed his invisibility cloak in his backpack and felt that, if it was good enough for Dumbledore, it ought to be good enough for the Ministry. Though now he came to think of it, he was not sure the Ministry knew about his cloak.
"Here you are, then,"
said the driver, a surprisingly short while later, speaking for the first time as he slowed in Charing Cross Road and stopped outside the Leaky Cauldron.
"I'm to wait for you. Any idea how long you'll be?"
"A couple of hours, I expect," said Mr. Weasley.
"Ah, good, he's here."
Harry imitated Mr. Weasley and peered through the window. His heart leapt. There were no Aurors waiting outside the inn, but instead the gigantic black-bearded form of Rubeus Hagrid, the Hogwarts gamekeeper, wearing a long beaver-skin coat, beaming at the sight of Harry's face and oblivious to the startled stares of passing muggles.
"Harry,"
he boomed, sweeping Harry into a bone-crushing hug the moment Harry had stepped out of the car.
"Buckbeak, with the wings, I mean. You should see him. Harry, he's so happy to be back in the open air."
"Glad he's pleased," said Harry, grinning as he massaged his ribs. "We didn't know security meant you."
"I know, just like old times, innit? You see, the Ministry wanted to send a bunch of Aurors, but Dumbledore said I'd do,"
said Hagrid proudly, throwing out his chest and tucking his thumbs into his pockets.
"Let's get going, then. After you, Molly, Arthur."
The Leaky Cauldron was, for the first time in Harry's memory, completely empty. Only Tom, the landlord, wizened and toothless, remained of the old crowd. He looked up hopefully as they entered, but before he could speak, Hagrid said importantly,
"Just passing through today, Tom. Sure you understand? Hogwarts business, you know."
Tom nodded gloomily and returned to wiping glasses. Harry, Hermione, Hagrid and the Weasleys walked through the bar and out into the chilly little courtyard at the back where the dustbins stood. Hagrid raised his pink umbrella and rapped a certain brick in the wall, which opened at once to form an archway onto a winding cobbled street. They stepped through the entrance and paused, looking around. Diagon Alley had changed. The colourful, glittering window displays of spellbooks, potion ingredients and cauldrons were lost to view, hidden behind the large Ministry of Magic posters that had been pasted over them.
Most of these somber purple posters carried blown-up versions of the security advice on the ministry pamphlets that had been sent out over the summer, but others bore moving black-and-white photographs of Death Eaters known to be on the loose. Bellatrix Lestrange was sneering from the front of the nearest apothecary. A few windows were boarded up, including those of Florian Fortescue's ice cream parlour. On the other hand, a number of shabby-looking stalls had sprung up along the street. The nearest one, which had been erected outside Flourish and Blotts, under a striped, stained awning, had a cardboard sign pinned to its front. Amulets, effective against werewolves, dementors, and inferi. A seedy-looking little wizard was rattling armfuls of silver symbols on chains at passers-by.
"One for your little girl, madam,"
he called at Mrs. Weasley as they passed, leering at Ginny.
"Protect her, pretty neck."
"If I were on duty,"
said Mr. Weasley, glaring angrily at the amulet seller.
"Yes, but don't go arresting anyone now, dear. We're in a hurry,"
said Mrs. Weasley, nervously consulting a list.
"I think we'd better do Madame Malkin's first. Hermione wants new dress robes, and Ron's showing much too much ankle in his school robes. You must need new ones too, Harry. You've grown so much. Come on, everyone!"
"Molly, it doesn't make sense for all of us to go to Madame Malkin's,"
said Mr. Weasley.
"Why don't those three go with Hagrid, and we can go to Flourish and Blotts and get everyone's school books?"
"I don't know,"
said Mrs. Weasley anxiously, clearly torn between a desire to finish the shopping quickly and the wish to stick together in a pack.
"Hagrid, do you think..."
"Don't fret, they'll be fine with me, Molly,"
said Hagrid soothingly, waving an airy hand the size of a dustbin lid. Mrs. Weasley did not look entirely convinced, but allowed the separation, scurrying off toward Flourish and Blotts with her husband and Ginny, while Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Hagrid set off for Madame Malkin's. Harry noticed that many of the people who passed them had the same harried, anxious look as Mrs. Weasley, and that nobody was stopping to talk any more. The shoppers stayed together in their own tightly knit groups, moving intently about their business. Nobody seemed to be shopping alone.
"Might be a bit of a squeeze in there with all of us,"
said Hagrid, stopping outside Madame Malkin's and bending down to peer through the window.
"I'll stand guard outside, all right?"
So Harry, Ron, and Hermione entered the little shop together. It appeared, at first glance, to be empty, but no sooner had the door swung shut behind them than they heard a familiar voice issuing from behind a rack of dress robes in spangled green and blue.
"Not a child, in case you haven't noticed, Mother. I'm perfectly capable of doing my shopping alone."
There was a clucking noise, and a voice Harry recognized as that of Madame Malkin, the owner, said,
"Now, dear, your mother's quite right. None of us is supposed to go wandering around on our own any more. It's nothing to do with being a child."
"Watch where you're sticking that pin, will you?"
A teenage boy with a pale, pointed face and white blonde hair appeared from behind the rack, wearing a handsome set of dark green robes that glittered with pins around the hem and the edges of the sleeves. He strode to the mirror and examined himself. It was a few moments before he noticed Harry, Ron, and Hermione reflected over his shoulder. His light grey eyes narrowed.
"If you're wondering what the smell is, Mother, a mudblood just walked in," said Draco Malfoy.
"I don't think there's any need for language like that,"
said Madame Malkin, scurrying out from behind the clothes rack, holding a tape measure and a wand.
"And I don't want wands drawn in my shop either,"
she added hastily, for a glance toward the door had shown her Harry and Ron both standing there with their wands out and pointing at Malfoy. Hermione, who was standing slightly behind them, whispered,
"No, don't. Honestly, it's not worth it."
"Yeah, like you dare do magic out of school," sneered Malfoy. "Who blacked your eye, Granger? I want to send them flowers."
"That's quite enough,"
said Madame Malkin sharply, looking over her shoulder for support.
"Madam, please."
Narcissa Malfoy strolled out from behind the clothes rack.
"Put those away," she said coldly to Harry and Ron. "If you attack my son again, I shall ensure that it is the last thing you ever do."
"Really?"
said Harry, taking a step forward and gazing into the smoothly arrogant face that, for all its pallor, still resembled her sister's. He was as tall as she was now. Going to get a few Death Eater pals to do us in, are you? Madame Malkin squealed and clutched at her heart.
Really, you shouldn't accuse. Dangerous thing to say. Wands away, please.
But Harry did not lower his wand. Narcissa Malfoy smiled unpleasantly.
I see that being Dumbledore's favorite has given you a false sense of security, Harry Potter. But Dumbledore won't always be there to protect you.
Harry looked mockingly all around the shop.
Wow, look at that. He's not here now, so why not have a go?
They might be able to find you a double cell in Azkaban with your loser of a husband. Malfoy made an angry movement toward Harry, but stumbled over his overlong robe. Ron laughed loudly.
Don't you dare talk to my mother like that, Potter, Malfoy snarled.
It's all right, Draco,
said Narcissa, restraining him with her thin white fingers upon his shoulder.
I expect Potter will be reunited with dear Sirius before I am reunited with Lucius.
Harry raised his wand higher.
Harry, no,
moaned Hermione, grabbing his arm and attempting to push it down by his side.
Think, you mustn't. You'll be in such trouble.
Madame Malkin dithered for a moment on the spot, then seemed to decide to act as though nothing was happening in the hope that it wouldn't. She bent toward Malfoy, who was still glaring at Harry.
I think this left sleeve should come up a little bit more, dear. Let me just... Ouch!
Bellowed Malfoy, slapping her hand away.
Watch where you're putting your pins, woman. Mother, I don't think I want these any more.
He pulled the robes over his head and threw them onto the floor at Madame Malkin's feet.
You're right, Draco, said Narcissa, with a contemptuous glance at Hermione. Now I know the kind of scum that shops here. We'll do better at Twilfit and Tatting's.
And with that, the pair of them strode out of the shop, Malfoy taking care to bang as hard as he could into Ron on the way out.
Well, really,
said Madame Malkin, snatching up the fallen robes and moving the tip of her wand over them like a vacuum cleaner so that it removed all the dust. She was distracted all through the fitting of Ron's and Harry's new robes, tried to sell Hermione wizard's dress robes instead of witches, and when she finally bowed them out of the shop, it was with an air of being glad to see the back of them.
Got everything?
Asked Hagrid brightly when they reappeared at his side.
Just about, said Harry.
Did you see the Malfoys?
Yeah, said Hagrid, unconcerned. But they wouldn't dare make trouble in the middle of Diagon Alley, Harry. Don't worry about them.
Harry, Ron, and Hermione exchanged looks. But before they could disabuse Hagrid of this comfortable notion, Mr. and Mrs. Weasley and Ginny appeared, all clutching heavy packages of books.
Everyone all right?
Said Mrs. Weasley.
Got your robes? Right then. We can pop in at the apothecary and Eyelops on the way to Fred and George's. Sit close now.
Neither Harry nor Ron brought any ingredients at the apothecary, seeing that they were no longer studying potions, but both brought large boxes of owl nuts for Hedwig and Pigwidgeon at Eyelops Owl Emporium. Then, with Mrs. Weasley checking her watch every minute or so, they headed farther along the street in search of Weasley's Wizard Wheezes, the joke shop run by Fred and George.
We really haven't got too long, Mrs. Weasley said, so we'll just have a quick look around and then back to the car. We must be close. That's number 92, 94...
Whoa, said Ron, stopping in his tracks. Set against the dull, poster-muffled shop fronts around them, Fred and George's windows hit the eye like a firework display. Casual passers-by were looking back over their shoulders at the windows, and a few rather stunned-looking people had actually come to a halt, transfixed. The left-hand window was dazzlingly full of an assortment of goods that revolved, popped, flashed, bounced, and shrieked. Harry's eyes began to water just looking at it. The right-hand window was covered with a gigantic poster, purple like those of the Ministry, but emblazoned with flashing yellow letters. Why are you worrying about you-know-who? You should be worrying about you-know-poo. The constipation sensation that's gripping the nation.
Harry started to laugh. He heard a weak sort of moan beside him and looked around to see Mrs. Weasley gazing, dumbfounded, at the poster. Her lips moved silently, mouthing the name, You Know Pooh.
"They'll be murdered in their beds," she whispered.
"No, they won't," said Ron, who, like Harry, was laughing.
"This is brilliant."
And he and Harry led the way into the shop. It was packed with customers. Harry could not get near the shelves. He stared around, looking up at the boxes piled to the ceiling. Here were the skiving snack boxes that the twins had perfected during their last unfinished year at Hogwarts. Harry noticed that the nosebleed nougat was most popular, with only one battered box left on the shelf. There were bins full of trick wands, the cheapest merely turning into rubber chickens or pairs of briefs when waved, the most expensive beating the unwary user around the head and neck, and boxes of quills, which came in self-inking, spell-checking, and smart-answer varieties. A space cleared in the crowd, and Harry pushed his way toward the counter, where a gaggle of delighted 10-year-olds was watching a tiny little wooden man slowly ascending the steps to a real set of gallows, both perched on a box that read, Reusable Hangman, spell it or he'll swing.
Patented daydream charms.
Hermione had managed to squeeze through to a large display near the counter and was reading the information on the back of a box bearing a highly coloured picture of a handsome youth and a swooning girl who was standing on the deck of a pirate ship.
One simple incantation and you will enter a top-quality, highly realistic, 30-minute daydream, easy to fit into the average school lesson and virtually undetectable. Side effects include vacant expression and minor drooling. Not for sale to under-16s.
You know, said Hermione, looking up at Harry, that really is extraordinary magic.
For that, Hermione, said a voice behind them, you can have one for free. A beaming Fred stood before them, wearing a set of magenta robes that clashed magnificently with his flaming hair. How are you, Harry? They shook hands. And what's happened to your eye, Hermione?
Your punching telescope, she said ruefully.
Oh, blimey! I forgot about those, said Fred. Here! He pulled a tub out of his pocket and handed it to her. She unscrewed it gingerly to reveal a thick yellow paste. Just dab it on. That bruise will be gone within the hour, said Fred. We had to find a decent bruise remover. We're testing most of our products on ourselves. Hermione looked nervous.
It is safe, isn't it? She asked.
Course it is, said Fred bracingly. Come on, Harry, I'll give you a tour. Harry left Hermione dabbing her black eye with paste and followed Fred toward the back of the shop, where he saw a stand of card and rope tricks.
Muggle magic tricks, said Fred happily, pointing them out. For freaks like Dad, you know, who love muggle stuff. It's not a big earner, but we do fairly steady business. They're great novelties. Oh, here's George.
Fred's twin shook Harry's hand energetically.
Giving him the tour? Come through the back, Harry. That's where we're making the real money. Pocket anything, you. And you'll pay in more than galleons,
he added warningly to a small boy who hastily whipped his hand out of a tub labelled Edible Dark Marks, They'll Make Anyone Sick. George pushed back a curtain beside the muggle tricks, and Harry saw a darker, less crowded room. The packaging on the products lining these shelves was more subdued.
We've just developed this more serious line, said Fred. Funny how it happened. You wouldn't believe how many people, even people who work at the Ministry, can't do a decent shield charm, said George. Course, they didn't have you teaching them, Harry.
That's right. Well, we thought shield hats were a bit of a laugh. You know, challenge your mate to jinx you while wearing it and watch his face when the jinx just bounces off.
But the Ministry bought 500 for all its support staff, and we're still getting massive orders.
So we've expanded into a range of shield cloaks, shield gloves. I mean, they wouldn't help much against the unforgivable curses, but for minor to moderate hexes or jinxes.
And then we thought we'd get into the whole area of defense against the dark arts, because it's such a money spinner, continued George enthusiastically. This is cool. Look, instant darkness powder.
We're importing it from Peru. Handy if you want to make a quick escape. And our decoy detonators are just walking off the shelves. Look, said Fred, pointing at a number of weird-looking black horn-type objects that were indeed attempting to scurry out of sight. You just drop one surreptitiously and it'll run off and make a nice loud noise out of sight, giving you a diversion if you need one.
Handy, said Harry, impressed.
Here, said George, catching a couple and throwing them to Harry. A young witch with short blonde hair poked her head around the curtain. Harry saw that she too was wearing magenta staff robes.
There's a customer out here looking for a joke cauldron, Mr. Weasley and Mr. Weasley, she said.
Harry found it very odd to hear Fred and George called Mr. Weasley, but they took it in their stride.
Right you are, Verity. I'm coming, said George promptly.
Harry, you help yourself to anything you want, all right? No charge.
I can't do that, said Harry, who had already pulled out his money bag to pay for the decoy detonators.
You don't pay here, said Fred firmly, waving away Harry's gold.
You gave us our start-up loan. We haven't forgotten, said George sternly. Take whatever you like and just remember to tell people where you got it, if they ask.
George swept off through the curtain to help with the customers, and Fred led Harry back into the main part of the shop to find Hermione and Ginny still poring over the patented daydream charms.
Haven't you girls found our special Wonder Witch products yet? Asked Fred.
Follow me, ladies.
Near the window was an array of violently pink products around which a cluster of excited girls was giggling enthusiastically. Hermione and Ginny both hung back, looking wary.
There you go, said Fred proudly. Best range of love potions you'll find anywhere.
Ginny raised an eyebrow skeptically.
Do they work? She asked.
Certainly they work, for up to 24 hours at a time, depending on the weight of the boy in question.
And the attractiveness of the girl,
said George, reappearing suddenly at their side.
But we're not selling them to our sister, he added, becoming suddenly stern. Not when she's already got about 5 boys on the go from what we've...
Whatever you've heard from Ron is a big fat lie, said Ginny calmly, leaning forward to take a small pink pot off the shelf.
What's this?
Guaranteed 10-second pimple vanisher, said Fred. Excellent on everything from boils to blackheads. But don't change the subject. Are you or are you not currently going out with a boy called Dean Thomas?
Yes, I am, said Ginny. And last time I looked, he was definitely one boy, not 5.
What are those?
She was pointing at a number of round balls of fluff in shades of pink and purple, all rolling around the bottom of a cage and emitting high-pitched squeaks.
Pygmy puffs, said George. Miniature puffskeins. We can't breed them fast enough. So what about Michael Corner?
I dumped him. He was a bad loser, said Ginny, putting a finger through the bars of the cage and watching the pygmy puffs crowd around it. They're really cute.
They're fairly cuddly, yes, conceded Fred. But you're moving through boyfriends a bit fast, aren't you?
Ginny turned to look at him, her hands on her hips. There was such a Mrs. Weasley-ish glare on her face that Harry was surprised Fred didn't recoil.
It's none of your business, and I'll thank you, she added angrily to Ron, who had just appeared at George's elbow, laden with merchandise, not to tell tales about me to these two.
That's, 3 galleons, 9 sickles, and a canut, said Fred, examining the many boxes in Ron's arms.
Cough up. I'm your brother.
And that's our stuff you're nicking. 3 galleons, 9 sickles, I'll knock off the canut.
But I haven't got 3 galleons, 9 sickles.
You'd better put it back then, and mind you put it on the right shelves.
Ron dropped several boxes, swore, and made a rude hand gesture at Fred that was unfortunately spotted by Mrs. Weasley, who had chosen that moment to appear.
If I see you do that again, I'll jinx your fingers together, she said sharply.
Mum, can I have a pygmy puff? Said Ginny at once.
A what? Said Mrs. Weasley warily. Look, they're so sweet.
Mrs. Weasley moved aside to look at the pygmy puffs, and Harry, Ron, and Hermione momentarily had an unimpeded view out of the window. Draco Malfoy was hurrying up the street alone. As he passed Weasley's wizard Wheezes, he glanced over his shoulder. Seconds later, he moved beyond the scope of the window, and they lost sight of him. "Wonder where his mummy is," said Harry, frowning.
"Given her the slip by the looks of it," said Ron.
"Why, though?"
said Hermione. Harry said nothing. He was thinking too hard. Narcissa Malfoy would not have let her precious son out of her sight willingly. Malfoy must have made a real effort to free himself from her clutches. Harry, knowing and loathing Malfoy, was sure the reason could not be innocent. He glanced around. Mrs. Weasley and Ginny were bending over the pygmy puffs. Mr. Weasley was delightedly examining a pack of muggle-marked playing cards. Fred and George were both helping customers. On the other side of the glass, Hagrid was standing with his back to them, looking up and down the street.
"Get under here, quick,"
said Harry, pulling his invisibility cloak out of his bag.
"Oh, I don't know, Harry,"
said Hermione, looking uncertainly toward Mrs. Weasley.
"Come on,"
said Ron. She hesitated for a second longer, then ducked under the cloak with Harry and Ron. Nobody noticed them vanish. They were all too interested in Fred and George's products. Harry, Ron, and Hermione squeezed their way out of the door as quickly as they could, but by the time they gained the street, Malfoy had disappeared just as successfully as they had.
"He was going in that direction,"
murmured Harry, as quietly as possible, so that the humming Hagrid would not hear them.
"Come on!"
They scurried along, peering left and right through shop windows and doors, until Hermione pointed ahead.
"That's him, isn't it?"
she whispered.
"Turning left."
"Big surprise," whispered Ron. For Malfoy had glanced around, then slid into Nocturne Alley and out of sight.
"Quick, or we'll lose him,"
said Harry, speeding up.
"Our feet'll be seen,"
said Hermione anxiously, as the cloak flapped a little around their ankles. It was much more difficult hiding all three of them under the cloak nowadays.
"It doesn't matter," said Harry impatiently. "Just hurry."
But Nocturne Alley, the side street devoted to the dark arts, looked completely deserted. They peered into windows as they passed, but none of the shops seemed to have any customers at all. Harry supposed it was a bit of a giveaway in these dangerous and suspicious times to buy dark artifacts, or at least to be seen buying them. Hermione gave his arm a hard pinch.
"Ouch! Shh! Look! He's in there!"
she breathed in Harry's ear. They had drawn level with the only shop in Nocturne Alley that Harry had ever visited, Borgin and Burke's, which sold a wide variety of sinister objects. There, in the midst of the cases full of skulls and old bottles, stood Draco Malfoy with his back to them, just visible beyond the very same large black cabinet in which Harry had once hidden to avoid Malfoy and his father. Judging by the movements of Malfoy's hands, he was talking animatedly. The proprietor of the shop, Mr. Borgin, an oily-haired, stooping man, stood facing Malfoy. He was wearing a curious expression of mingled resentment and fear.
"If only we could hear what they're saying," said Hermione.
"We can,"
said Ron excitedly.
"Hang on! Damn!"
He dropped a couple more of the boxes he was still clutching as he fumbled with the largest.
"Extendable ears. Look,
fantastic,"
said Hermione, as Ron unraveled the long, flesh-colored strings and began to feed them toward the bottom of the door.
"Oh, I hope the door isn't imperturbable."
"No,"
said Ron gleefully.
"Listen."
They put their heads together and listened intently to the ends of the strings, through which Malfoy's voice could be heard loud and clear, as though a radio had been turned on.
"You know how to fix it."
"Possibly,"
said Borgin in a tone that suggested he was unwilling to commit himself.
"I'll need to see it, though. Why don't you bring it into the shop?"
"I can't," said Malfoy. "It's got to stay put. I just need you to tell me how to do it."
Harry saw Borgin lick his lips nervously.
"Well, without seeing it, I must say it will be a very difficult job. Perhaps impossible. I couldn't guarantee anything."
"No," said Malfoy, and Harry knew just by his tone that Malfoy was sneering. "Perhaps this will make you more confident."
He moved toward Borgin and was blocked from view by the cabinet.
Harry, Ron and Hermione shuffled sideways to try and keep him in sight, but all they could see was Borgin looking very frightened.
"Tell anyone," said Malfoy, "and there will be retribution. You know Fenrir Greyback? He's a family friend. He'll be dropping in from time to time to make sure you're giving the problem your full attention."
"There will be no need for..."
"I'll decide that," said Malfoy. "Well, I'd better be off, and don't forget to keep that one safe. I'll need it."
"Perhaps you'd like to take it now?"
"No, of course I wouldn't, you stupid little man. How would I look carrying that down the street? Just don't sell it."
"Of course not, sir."
Borgin made a bow as deep as the one Harry had once seen him give Lucius Malfoy.
"Not a word to anyone, Borgin, and that includes my mother. Understand?"
"Naturally, naturally," murmured Borgin, bowing again.
Next moment the bell over the door tinkled loudly as Malfoy stalked out of the shop, looking very pleased with himself. He passed so close to Harry, Ron and Hermione that they felt the cloak flutter around their knees again. Inside the shop, Borgin remained frozen. His anxious smile had vanished. He looked worried.
"What was that about?"
whispered Ron, reeling in the extendable ears.
"Dunno,"
said Harry, thinking hard.
"He wants something mended, and he wants to reserve something in there. Could you see what he pointed at when he said, 'That one'?"
"No, he was behind that cabinet."
"You do stay here,"
whispered Hermione. "What are you—" But Hermione had already ducked out from under the cloak. She checked her hair in the reflection in the glass, then marched into the shop, setting the bell tinkling again. Ron hastily fed the extendable ears back under the door and passed one of the strings to Harry.
"Hello. Horrible morning, isn't it?"
Hermione said brightly to Borgin, who did not answer, but cast her a suspicious look. Humming cheerily, Hermione strolled through the jumble of objects on display.
"Is this necklace for sale?"
she asked, pausing beside a glass-fronted case.
"If you've got 1,500 galleons," said Mr. Borgin coldly.
No, I haven't got quite that much," said Hermione, walking on. "And what about this lovely, skull?"
16 galleons."
"So, it's for sale, then? It isn't being kept for anyone?"
Mr. Borgin squinted at her. Harry had the nasty feeling he knew exactly what Hermione was up to. Apparently Hermione felt she had been rumbled too, because she suddenly threw caution to the winds.
"The thing is, that, boy who was in here just now, Draco Malfoy, well, he's a friend of mine, and I want to get him a birthday present. But if he's already reserved anything, I obviously don't want to get him the same thing. So,
It was a pretty lame story in Harry's opinion, and apparently Borgin thought so too.
"Out!" he said sharply. "Get out!"
Hermione did not wait to be asked twice, but hurried to the door with Borgin at her heels. As the bell tinkled again, Borgin slammed the door behind her and put up the closed sign.
"Ah, well," said Ron, throwing the cloak back over Hermione.
"Worth a try, but you were a bit obvious."
"Well, next time you can show me how it's done, master of mystery," she snapped.
Ron and Hermione bickered all the way back to Weasley's Wizard Wheezes, where they were forced to stop so that they could dodge undetected around a very anxious-looking Mrs. Weasley and Hagrid, who had clearly noticed their absence. Once in the shop, Harry whipped off the invisibility cloak, hit it in his bag, and joined in with the other two when they insisted, in answer to Mrs. Weasley's accusations, that they had been in the back room all along, and that she could not have looked properly.
Chapter 7 The Slug Club.
Harry spent a lot of the last week of the holidays pondering the meaning of Malfoy's behavior in Nocturne Alley. What disturbed him most was the satisfied look on Malfoy's face as he had left the shop. Nothing that made Malfoy look that happy could be good news.
To his slight annoyance, however, neither Ron nor Hermione seemed quite as curious about Malfoy's activities as he was, or at least they seemed to get bored of discussing it after a few days.
"Yes, I've already agreed it was fishy, Harry," said Hermione a little impatiently.
She was sitting on the windowsill in Fred and George's room with her feet up on one of the cardboard boxes and had only grudgingly looked up from her new copy of Advanced Rune Translation.
"But haven't we agreed there could be a lot of explanations?"
"Maybe he's broken his hand of glory,"
said Ron vaguely as he attempted to straighten his broomstick's bent tail twigs.
"Remember that shriveled up arm Malfoy had?"
"But what about when he said, 'Don't forget to keep that one safe'?" asked Harry for the umpteenth time. "That sounded to me like Borgin's got another one of the broken objects, and Malfoy wants both."
"You reckon?" said Ron, now trying to scrape some dirt off his broom handle.
"Yeah, I do," said Harry.
When neither Ron nor Hermione answered, he said, "Malfoy's father's in Azkaban. Don't you think Malfoy'd like revenge?" Ron looked up, blinking.
"Malfoy? Revenge? What can he do about it?"
"That's my point. I don't know," said Harry, frustrated.
"But he's up to something, and I think we should take it seriously. His father's a Death Eater, and..."
Harry broke off, his eyes fixed on the window behind Hermione, his mouth open. A startling thought had just occurred to him.
"Harry,"
said Hermione in an anxious voice.
"What's wrong?"
"Your scar's not hurting again, is it?"
asked Ron nervously.
"He's a Death Eater," said Harry slowly. "He's replaced his father as a Death Eater."
There was a silence. Then Ron erupted in laughter.
"Malfoy? He's 16, Harry. Do you think you know who would let Malfoy join?"
"It seems very unlikely, Harry,"
said Hermione in a repressive sort of voice.
"What makes you think?"
"In Madame Malkin's. She didn't touch him, but he yelled and jerked his arm away from her when she went to roll up his sleeve. It was his left arm. He's been branded with the dark mark."
Ron and Hermione looked at each other.
"Well," said Ron, sounding thoroughly unconvinced.
"I think he just wanted to get out of there, Harry," said Hermione.
"He showed Borgin something we couldn't see," Harry pressed on stubbornly. "Something that seriously scared Borgin.
It was the mark. I know it.
He was showing Borgin who he was dealing with. You saw how seriously Borgin took him."
Ron and Hermione exchanged another look.
"I'm not sure, Harry."
"Yeah, I still don't reckon you know who would let Malfoy join."
Annoyed but absolutely convinced he was right, Harry snatched up a pile of filthy Quidditch robes and left the room. Mrs. Weasley had been urging them for days not to leave their washing and packing until the last moment. On the landing, he bumped into Ginny, who was returning to her room, carrying a pile of freshly laundered clothes.
"I wouldn't go in the kitchen just now," she warned him. "There's a lot of phlegm around."
"I'll be careful not to slip in it," Harry smiled.
Sure enough, when he entered the kitchen, it was to find Fleur sitting at the kitchen table in full flow about plans for her wedding to Bill, while Mrs. Weasley kept watch over a pile of self-peeling sprouts, looking bad-tempered.
"Bill and I have almost decided on only two bridesmaids. Jeannie and Gabrielle will look very sweet together. I am thinking of dressing them in pale gold. Pink would, of course, be horrible with Jeannie's hair."
"Ah, Harry,"
said Mrs. Weasley loudly, cutting across Fleur's monologue.
"Good. I wanted to explain about the security arrangements for the journey to Hogwarts tomorrow. We've got ministry cars again, and there will be Aurors waiting at the station."
"Is Tonks going to be there?" asked Harry, handing over his Quidditch things.
"No, I don't think so. She's been stationed somewhere else, from what Arthur said." "She has let herself go, that Tonks,"
Fleur mused, examining her own stunning reflection in the back of a teaspoon.
"A big mistake, if you ask." "Yes, thank you," said Mrs. Weasley tartly, cutting across Fleur again. "You'd better get on, Harry. I want the trunks ready tonight, if possible, so we don't have the usual last-minute scramble."
And in fact, their departure the following morning was smoother than usual. The ministry cars glided up to the front of the burrow to find them waiting, trunks packed. Hermione's cat, Crookshanks, safely enclosed in his travelling basket, and Hedwig, Ron's owl, Pigwidgeon, and Ginny's new purple pygmy puff, Arnold, in cages.
"Au revoir, Harry,"
said Fleur throatily, kissing him goodbye. Ron hurried forward, looking hopeful, but Ginny stuck out her foot, and Ron fell, sprawling in the dust at Fleur's feet. Furious, red-faced and dirt-spattered, he hurried into the car without saying goodbye. There was no cheerful Hagrid waiting for them at King's Cross Station. Instead, two grim-faced, bearded Aurors in dark muggle suits moved forward the moment the car stopped, and, flanking the party, marched them into the station without speaking.
"Quick, quick, through the barrier,"
said Mrs. Weasley, who seemed a little flustered by this austere efficiency.
"Harry had better go first, with—"
She looked inquiringly at one of the Aurors, who nodded briefly, seized Harry's upper arm, and attempted to steer him toward the barrier between platforms 9 and 10.
"I can walk, thanks,"
said Harry irritably, jerking his arm out of the Auror's grip. He pushed his trolley directly at the solid barrier, ignoring his silent companion, and found himself a second later standing on platform 9 3/4, where the Scarlet Hogwarts Express stood belching steam over the crowd. Hermione and the Weasleys joined him within seconds. Without waiting to consult his grim-faced Auror, Harry motioned to Ron and Hermione to follow him up the platform, looking for an empty compartment.
"We can't, Harry,"
said Hermione, looking apologetic.
"Ron and I've got to go to the prefect's carriage first, and then patrol the corridors for a bit."
"Oh, yeah, I forgot,"
said Harry.
"You'd better get straight on the train, all of you. You've only got a few minutes to go,"
said Mrs. Weasley, consulting her watch.
"Well, have a lovely term, Ron."
"Mr. Weasley, can I have a quick word?" said Harry, making up his mind on the spur of the moment.
"Of course,"
said Mr. Weasley, who looked slightly surprised but followed Harry out of earshot of the others nevertheless. Harry had thought it through carefully and come to the conclusion that, if he was to tell anyone, Mr. Weasley was the right person. Firstly, because he worked at the ministry and was therefore in the best position to make further investigations, and secondly, because he thought that there was not too much risk of Mr. Weasley exploding with anger. He could see Mrs. Weasley and the grim-faced Auror casting the pair of them suspicious looks as they moved away.
"When we were in Diagon Alley,"
Harry began, but Mr. Weasley forestalled him with a grimace.
"Am I about to discover where you, Ron, and Hermione disappeared to while you were supposed to be in the back room of Fred and George's shop?
How did you—"
"Harry, please. You're talking to the man who raised Fred and George."
Yeah.
"All right, we weren't in the back room." "Very well, then. Let's hear the worst."
"Well, we followed Draco Malfoy. We used my invisibility cloak."
"Did you have any particular reason for doing so, or was it a mere whim?"
"Because I thought Malfoy was up to something," said Harry, disregarding Mr. Weasley's look of mingled exasperation and amusement. "He'd given his mother the slip, and I wanted to know why."
"Of course you did," said Mr. Weasley, sounding resigned. "Well, did you find out why?"
"He went into Borgin and Burke's," said Harry, "and started bullying the bloke in there, Borgin, to help him fix something. And he said he wanted Borgin to keep something else for him. He made it sound like it was the same kind of thing that needed fixing, like they were a pair. And—"
Harry took a deep breath.
"There's something else. We saw Malfoy jump about a mile when Madame Malkin tried to touch his left arm. I think he's been branded with the dark mark. I think he's replaced his father as a Death Eater."
Mr. Weasley looked taken aback. After a moment he said,
"Harry, I doubt whether you know who would allow a 16-year-old—"
"Does anyone really know what you know who would or wouldn't do?"
asked Harry angrily.
"Mr. Weasley, I'm sorry, but isn't it worth investigating?
If Malfoy wants something fixed, and he needs to threaten Borgin to get it done, it's probably something dark or dangerous, isn't it?
I doubt it, to be honest, Harry, said Mr. Weasley slowly. You see, when Lucius Malfoy was arrested, we raided his house. We took away everything that might have been dangerous.
I think you missed something, said Harry stubbornly.
Well, maybe, said Mr. Weasley, but Harry could tell that Mr. Weasley was humouring him. There was a whistle behind them. Nearly everyone had boarded the train, and the doors were closing.
You'd better hurry, said Mr. Weasley, as Mrs. Weasley cried, Harry, quickly!
He hurried forward, and Mr. and Mrs. Weasley helped him load his trunk onto the train.
Now, dear, you're coming to us for Christmas. It's all fixed with Dumbledore. So, we'll see you quite soon,
said Mrs. Weasley through the window, as Harry slammed the door shut behind him and the train began to move.
You make sure you look after yourself, and...
The train was gathering speed.
Be good, and...
She was jogging to keep up now.
Stay safe.
Harry waved until the train had turned a corner and Mr. and Mrs. Weasley were lost to view, then turned to see where the others had got to. He supposed Ron and Hermione were cloistered in the prefect's carriage, but Ginny was a little way along the corridor, chatting to some friends. He made his way toward her, dragging his trunk. People stared shamelessly as he approached. They even pressed their faces against the windows of their compartments to get a look at him. He had expected an upswing in the amount of gaping and gawping he would have to endure this term after all the Chosen One rumours in the Daily Prophet, but he did not enjoy the sensation of standing in a very bright spotlight. He tapped Ginny on the shoulder.
Fancy trying to find a compartment?
I can't, Harry. I said I'd meet Dean, said Ginny brightly. See you later.
Right, said Harry.
He felt a strange twinge of annoyance as she walked away, her long red hair dancing behind her. He had become so used to her presence over the summer that he had almost forgotten that Ginny did not hang around with him, Ron, and Hermione while at school. Then he blinked and looked around. He was surrounded by mesmerized girls.
"Hi, Harry," said a familiar voice from behind him.
"Neville!" said Harry in relief, turning to see a round-faced boy struggling toward him.
"Hello, Harry,"
said a girl with long hair and large misty eyes, who was just behind Neville.
"Luna, hi, how are you?"
"Very well, thank you,"
said Luna. She was clutching a magazine to her chest. Large letters on the front announced that there was a pair of free spectre specs inside.
"Quibbler, still going strong then?" asked Harry,
who felt a certain fondness for the magazine, having given it an exclusive interview the previous year.
"Oh, yes, circulation's well up,"
said Luna happily. "Let's find seats," said Harry, and the three of them set off along the train through hordes of silently staring students. At last they found an empty compartment, and Harry hurried inside gratefully.
"They're even staring at us," said Neville, indicating himself and Luna, "because we're with you."
"They're staring at you because you were at the Ministry, too," said Harry as he hoisted his trunk into the luggage rack. "Our little adventure there was all over the Daily Prophet. You must have seen it."
"Yes, I thought Gran would be angry about all the publicity," said Neville, "but she was really pleased. Says I'm starting to live up to my dad at long last. She bought me a new wand, look."
He pulled it out and showed it to Harry.
"Cherry and unicorn hair," he said proudly. "We think it was one of the last Ollivander ever sold. He vanished next day. Oi, come back here, Trevor!"
And he dived under the seat to retrieve his toad as it made one of its frequent bids for freedom.
"Are we still doing DA meetings this year, Harry?" asked Luna,
who was detaching a pair of psychedelic spectacles from the middle of the Quibbler.
"No point now we've got rid of Umbridge, is there?"
said Harry, sitting down. Neville bumped his head against the seat as he emerged from under it. He looked most disappointed.
"I liked the DA. I learned loads with you."
"I enjoyed the meetings too," said Luna serenely. "It was like having friends."
This was one of those uncomfortable things Luna often said and which made Harry feel a squirming mixture of pity and embarrassment. Before he could respond, however, there was a disturbance outside their compartment door. A group of fourth-year girls was whispering and giggling together on the other side of the glass.
You ask him.
No, you. I'll do it.
And one of them, a bold-looking girl with large dark eyes, a prominent chin, and long black hair, pushed her way through the door.
Hi, Harry. I'm Romilda Vane, she said loudly and confidently. Why don't you join us in our compartment? You don't have to sit with them,
she added in a stage whisper, indicating Neville's bottom, which was sticking out from under the seat again as he groped around for Trevor, and Luna, who was now wearing her free spectre specs, which gave her the look of a demented, multicolored owl. They're friends of mine, said Harry coldly.
Oh,
said the girl, looking very surprised.
Oh, okay.
And she withdrew, sliding the door closed behind her.
People expect you to have cooler friends than us,
said Luna, once again displaying her knack for embarrassing honesty.
You are cool, said Harry shortly. None of them was at the ministry. They didn't fight with me.
That's a very nice thing to say,
beamed Luna. Then she pushed her spectre specs farther up on her nose and settled down to read the Quibbler.
We didn't face him, though,
said Neville, emerging from under the seat with fluff and dust in his hair and a resigned-looking Trevor in his hand.
You did. You should hear my grand talk about you. That Harry Potter's got more backbone than the whole Ministry of Magic put together. She'd give anything to have you as a grandson.
Harry laughed uncomfortably and changed the subject to OWL results as soon as he could. While Neville recited his grades and wondered aloud whether he would be allowed to take a transfiguration NEWT with only an acceptable, Harry watched him without really listening. Neville's childhood had been blighted by Voldemort just as much as Harry's had, but Neville had no idea how close he had come to having Harry's destiny. The prophecy could have referred to either of them, yet, for his own inscrutable reasons, Voldemort had chosen to believe that Harry was the one meant. Had Voldemort chosen Neville, it would be Neville sitting opposite Harry, bearing the lightning-shaped scar and the weight of the prophecy. Or would it? Would Neville's mother have died to save him, as Lily had died for Harry? Surely she would, but what if she had been unable to stand between her son and Voldemort? Would there then have been no chosen one at all? An empty seat where Neville now sat, and a scarless Harry who would have been kissed goodbye by his own mother, not Ron's?
You all right, Harry? You look funny, said Neville.
Harry started. Sorry, I...
Raxbert got you?
Asked Luna sympathetically, peering at Harry through her enormous coloured spectacles.
I... What? A Raxbert. They're invisible. They float in through your ears and make your brain go fuzzy, she said. I thought I felt one zooming around in here.
She flapped her hands at thin air, as though beating off large invisible moths. Harry and Neville caught each other's eyes and hastily began to talk of Quidditch. The weather beyond the train windows was as patchy as it had been all summer. They passed through stretches of the chilling mist, then out into weak, clear sunlight. It was during one of the clear spells, when the sun was visible almost directly overhead, that Ron and Hermione entered the compartment at last.
"Wish the lunch trolley would hurry up. I'm starving,"
said Ron longingly, slumping into the seat beside Harry and rubbing his stomach.
"Hi, Neville. Hi, Luna.
Guess what?"
he added, turning to Harry.
"Malfoy's not doing prefect duty. He's just sitting in his compartment with the other Slytherins. We saw him when we passed."
Harry sat up straight, interested. It was not like Malfoy to pass up the chance to demonstrate his power as prefect, which he had happily abused all the previous year. "What did he do when he saw you?"
"The usual," said Ron indifferently, demonstrating a rude hand gesture. "Not like him, though, is it? Well, that is."
He did the hand gesture again.
"But why isn't he out there bullying first years?" "Dunno,"
said Harry, but his mind was racing. Didn't this look as though Malfoy had more important things on his mind than bullying younger students?
Maybe he preferred the inquisitorial squad, said Hermione. Maybe being a prefect seems a bit tame after that.
I don't think so, said Harry. I think he's... But before he could expound on his theory, the compartment door slid open again and a breathless third-year girl stepped inside.
I'm supposed to deliver these to Neville Longbottom and Harry Potter,
she faltered as her eyes met Harry's and she turned scarlet. She was holding out two scrolls of parchment tied with violet ribbon. Perplexed, Harry and Neville took the scroll addressed to each of them, and the girl stumbled back out of the compartment.
"What is it?"
Ron demanded as Harry unrolled his.
"An invitation," said Harry.
"Harry, I would be delighted if you would join me for a bite of lunch in Compartment C. Sincerely, Professor H.E.F. Slughorn."
"Who's Professor Slughorn?"
asked Neville, looking perplexedly at his own invitation.
"New teacher," said Harry.
"Well, I suppose we'll have to go, won't we?"
"But what does he want me for?"
asked Neville nervously, as though he was expecting detention.
"No idea," said Harry, which was not entirely true, though he had no proof yet that his hunch was correct.
"Listen,"
he added, seized by a sudden brainwave.
"Let's go under the invisibility cloak, then we might get a look at Malfoy on the way, see what he's up to."
This idea, however, came to nothing. The corridors, which were packed with people on the lookout for the lunch trolley, were impossible to negotiate while wearing the cloak. Harry stowed it regretfully back in his bag, reflecting that it would have been nice to wear it just to avoid all the staring, which seemed to have increased in intensity even since he had last walked down the train. Every now and then, students would hurtle out of their compartments to get a better look at him. The exception was Cho Chang, who darted into her compartment when she saw Harry coming. As Harry passed the window, he saw her deep in determined conversation with her friend Marietta, who was wearing a very thick layer of makeup that did not entirely obscure the odd formation of pimples still etched across her face. Smirking slightly, Harry pushed on. When they reached Compartment C, they saw at once that they were not Slughorn's only invitees. Although, judging by the enthusiasm of Slughorn's welcome, Harry was the most warmly anticipated.
"Harry, my boy,"
said Slughorn, jumping up at the sight of him so that his great velvet-covered belly seemed to fill all the remaining space in the compartment. His shiny bald head and great silvery moustache gleamed as brightly in the sunlight as the golden buttons on his waistcoat.
"Good to see you, good to see you. And you must be Mr. Longbottom."
Neville nodded, looking scared. At a gesture from Slughorn, they sat down opposite each other in the only two empty seats, which were nearest the door. Harry glanced around at their fellow guests. He recognized a Slytherin from their year, a tall black boy with high cheekbones and long slanting eyes. There were also two seventh-year boys Harry did not know, and, squashed in the corner beside Slughorn and looking as though she was not entirely sure how she had got there, Ginny.
"Now, do you know everyone?"
Slughorn asked Harry and Neville.
"Blaise Zabini is in your year, of course."
Zabini did not make any sign of recognition or greeting, nor did Harry or Neville. Gryffindor and Slytherin students loathed each other on principle.
"This is Cormac McLagan. Perhaps you've come across each other."
"No?" McLagan, a large, wiry-haired youth, raised a hand, and Harry and Neville nodded back at him.
"And this is Marcus Belby. I don't know whether..."
Belby, who was thin and nervous-looking, gave a strained smile.
"And this charming young lady tells me she knows you," Slughorn finished.
Ginny grimaced at Harry and Neville from behind Slughorn's back.
"Well, now, this is most pleasant," said Slughorn cozily. "A chance to get to know you all a little better. Here, take a napkin. I've packed my own lunch. The trolley, as I remember it,
is heavy on licorice wands, and a poor old man's digestive system isn't quite up to such things. Pheasant, Belby?
Belby started and accepted what looked like half a cold pheasant.
I was just telling young Marcus here that I had the pleasure of teaching his uncle Damocles.
Slughorn told Harry and Neville, now passing around a basket of rolls.
Outstanding wizard, outstanding, and his Order of Merlin most well-deserved. Do you see much of your uncle, Marcus?
Unfortunately, Belby had just taken a large mouthful of pheasant. In his haste to answer Slughorn, he swallowed too fast, turned purple, and began to choke.